reality and reality and breathing and squeezing out all the holes and all the vacuous, inattentive parts of yourself, so that you become more dense and more real and more consistently a divine organism, so that your life becomes a benediction, so that everything you do, whether you're waking up in the morning, eating food, washing something, sitting on the toilet, speaking with someone, doing whatever your work is, driving, none of this is like going, becoming inattentive and allowing yourself to be ruled by whatever forces might be around to kind of influence you subliminally. It means staying conscious, staying totally conscious at all times of yourself as fixed on being a being of benediction, and especially in your relationship to all the elements around you and all the environment around you. And that is not a difficult thing to do, but it's a focus, it's a direction, it's a keeping, it's a practice. So as in meditation, when you first begin single-pointed meditation, you're able to hold it for a while, and then all of a sudden you realize you've drifted, so you come back to it. And then you hold it for a while, and you realize you've drifted, you come back to it. When you first start, you may spend three-quarters of your time drifting and one-quarter of your time focusing, but after you practice it for a few months, you spend 90% of your time focusing and 10% of your time drifting. And people who count their breaths, they can only get up to 7 or 8 or 9 when they first start before all of a sudden they lose count when they're doing breathing exercises. People that are very focused will count to 25 or 30, and some people can count indefinitely and never lose their focus. And I have mentally gifted students in my school that can go do as well at age 12 or 13 as quite a practiced a meditator can do with breathing meditations. I've had an amrita, for example, was able to just go and go and go. And that's because that's what she had built in herself before this incarnation. Being real, being dense, being densely here is being real. So, blessing the earth and the spirits and the environment, honoring them, communing with them, cooperating with them, and communicating with them. You can, and you should learn to talk to the so-called inanimate objects around you. Not just plants or insects or other kinds of things, but stones, oceans, clouds, your automobile, the things about you that you have soaked with your own vibrations, even your clothing. See it as conscious and speak to it, even though it can't speak back to you in a certain kind of way, it will speak back to you another kind of way. And it's not what you say, it's what you think, it's what you intend. It's you're relating, you're interrelating with all these elements or these elementals. Now, I say all this because what I'm giving you is a kind of map. What I'm giving you is a kind of map that tells you how to get around in some situation that you are ignorant of. But if the map is good and if the map is real, then it works and it gets you there. Let us say you know all the details of that, everything a mechanic would know about what makes a car run, an electrician, and everything else. That doesn't mean you can drive the car. That doesn't mean you even know how to turn it on or that what side of the road to drive on or anything like else. You may have all the technical knowledge, and that doesn't mean you can get from point A to point B in an automobile. But you can be totally ignorant of mechanical knowledge of how the car runs, what makes this happen, all these kinds of things, and you can still turn it on and get from point A to point B. In fact, you could be one of the world's greatest drivers, race car drivers or whatever, without knowing any of that stuff. Well, the universe is user-friendly. You do not have to know the mechanics of consciousness, of how it works that you can communicate with a tree, or that you can do this, you can do that. It is user-friendly. The car is built user-friendly. It's meant to be turned on by someone who knows nothing about mechanics and driven, and when something goes wrong, you pull over and call the car company and they come and pick it up. Everything in the universe is user-friendly. That is why we can communicate just with, in whatever terms we want, we can use. Nature spirits can instantly communicate in any language we want because they come from behind the language. You just project the whole concept package with some kind of a sound or with any kinds of things. When you know the map, when you understand what the user-friendly map is of the universe and of elemental beings, you can get a desired result 100 different ways, with 1,000 different ceremonies and actions, or even without need of ceremony. Ceremonies actually are needed only by illegitimate usurpers who want unearned and undeserved results. Those who work by theft and like treasure raiders coming with a whole lot of arms around them. There's no reason to be afraid of any elementals. There's no reason to be afraid of any beings at all. There's no reason really to have fear of anything in the invisible world. Jesus, when he came upon the man who was born blind, he spat upon some earth and made it into a little mud and put it on the man's eyes, and the man, when it was washed off, he could see. Now, Jesus didn't have to do it that way. He could have done it lots of other ways. He could have breathed on his eyes. He could have kissed his eyes. He could have bathed his eyes. He could have knocked the guy in the head with a certain kind of branch. He could have rubbed the soles of his feet. He could have accomplished what was to be accomplished at that point lots of different ways. That was just the way he did it then. And it's the same with you. When you know the map, when you understand the realities, you don't have to do any ceremonies you do will simply be to facilitate your speaking something into order, into existence, into a certain kind of way. Because of having divine authority as a co-creator with God. Now the first elemental you must reconcile with, and the elemental, the one we call the elemental, but it's actually really a whole package of all kinds of elementals, is your own physical body. It's your child. It has its fears, it has its worries, its discontents, its dislikes, its personality. Your body has its own personality. It's made up of a whole lot of different things. Yet, it does amazing and wondrous maybe billion function protoplasmic kind of vehicle with all seven kinds of substance, including four fiery substances, chemical, vital, and luminous, and reflective, all of which must serve the monadic self, not the personal selves, which are rampant, and the ego states, which are rampant throughout the elemental as it's without any higher principles, as it is a conglomeration on the psychic level. And there are many, many, many such elementals held in a kind of loosely together in the ego sense of I, as we've talked about before. And one of the first responsibilities you have to this elemental that serves you, it is your servant. This is your first servant. This is your first elemental who serves you. Once you have reconciled with this, and once you have made your body your true friend and your really happy home, and have provided for it, because it's not a matter of you being a king and it being a servant and that's just the way it is. No. What does the king provide for the servant? He provides every need the servant has. His education, his leisure, his basic food and drink, his connubial happiness, everything else. All this is provided for by the king, who is served by a servant. And you better remember that. If you want to be served, you must serve the servant. Jesus said he washed the feet of his disciples to show them that he served them, even though they saw themselves as servants of Christ later on. And you as a king must serve your elemental being, your body to start with, and all that serve you, because they're not serving you. They're serving through you, through your leadership. They are serving the higher nature and the monadic nature and that which is evolving in humanity and that which is overcoming the dark forces and so on. So the very first thing you have, besides the basic physical things of taking care of your body, of nourishing it, of cleansing it, keeping it clean from infection and so on a physical level, and don't not overdoing it, not overtiring it, not making it unhealthy and all this other thing, but of taking care of it, nurturing it that way, on the invisible level is protection. You have to protect your body from invasion. And this is why we say at nighttime, don't wash your face before you go to bed, because your body, when it lies there in the bed with you not in it, when it lies as your first principle, alone, exposed on your bed, as you may have retreated with your six other principles or the four other principles that you have active in your astral body, leaving it there with just a bare thread connecting it to keep it vital and alive so that it can receive its share of vital energy and so on. When you leave it there like that, you must leave it protected, just the same way you would leave, if you leave your children at home, you must have a babysitter, you must have something. They can't just take care of themselves. And so every night when you go to sleep, don't wash your face, because that's where the highest concentration of your own magnetic fluids, which helps connect you to your auric self, is. And if you wash your face right and go to sleep each night, you're basically removing certain kinds of protection. If you feel you are in some kind of psychic danger or in some kind of psychic attack, then you need to use, in our temple, we use something that is a little more advanced than a pentagram kind of ritual at nighttime, which I won't go in details with through on this tape, but it is a very powerful form of protection that is rooted in the empowerments that we receive in the temple. And when you do wake up in the morning, then you must wash your face and especially your eyes to remove the etheric fluids that are left there by lower astral and all kinds of other beings and denizens who seek some kind of asylum or some kind of parasitic life from the vital energy of your body, and have been close to it, and have been close to inhabiting it, or have possibly even inhabited it partially, or whatever, the body, then that is the most important cleansing you can do in the morning, is to remove, is to wash your face and your eyes when you get up. Now, you may wash your hands before you go to sleep at night. In fact, it's good to wash your hands lots of times, depending upon the situation, sometimes up to your elbows. But your face you leave, and then in the morning you wash it, and that is one way of protecting your body. Another way is what you take in, food and water perception, blessing that in the invisible worlds, not just making sure what you eat is good food, but actually blessing it so that when it comes in, it brings good spiritual nourishment with it as well. Purity practices, the uses of fragrances, other kinds of subtle means we've talked about. Now, Saint Germain, the Comte de Saint Germain, and what he has left behind, or what we feel is historical that he's left behind, has said that he has developed, that he himself as a master has developed a technique of preserving the health of the physical body as it is at the age of 50. And if you've done a good job with your body, you'll have a nice healthy body when you're 50, for another 50 years. Something words to that effect. This, why does a master wish to preserve his body? Why? What's the importance of it? Well, because your body is your vehicle, and also because it's that which you owe something to. But most of all, it is that which serves the higher purpose that you yourself serve. And if you lose your health or your mental balance or anything else because the body is not taken care of properly, then you lose your effectiveness. Then basically the incarnation is not, it becomes less and less significant. And it becomes a good idea just to leave. The trouble is when you leave the body, you have to, the only way you come back is through another birth. And that's a whole lot, you have to reinvent the wheel each time you come back. But you have certain things to help you. Well, so these practices have been developed by masters that we call, that in the Tibetan are called long life practices, that have been, of course, perverted in Buddhism to be sort of healing things that people who have something wrong with them go to Tibetan lamas to get practices so they can, after it's already kind of too late. But the long life practices are initially developed, and Padmasambhava himself developed them with the great female master Mandarava. Before he did his major work in Tibet, he did long life practices with her, and it was work that he did with her that was esoteric work. And these practices in Tibetan are passed down in different traditions, but basically they are to prolong the life and the vitality of the flesh and of the body so that one can preach and carry on the Dharma. And so when one works towards mastery, one of the things one must work towards is the nurture and the prolongation of one's life and flesh. Because at the personal level, one accumulates more and more wisdom. When you get on a roll with this stuff, you want to keep going. You don't want to drop dead all of a sudden of a heart attack, or have your arteries harden, or have a stroke, or have other kinds of things go wrong. Because there, all of a sudden, a great light is going, and suddenly, poof, it's gone. And you owe it to the teachings, and you owe it to yourself to take seriously these long life practices. We have, in the West, our practices are very simple. They have to do with doctors and physical hygiene and preventative medicines, and some of them are very good things, and many of them are much better than things that were developed. But there are also spiritual dimensions of this that are much more advanced than Western medicine has. Let us say that one has done the work, one has gained communication with one's body cells, one is able to do daily practices that keep the body healthy and prolong it towards its best life. The best life of a body, each body has self-destruct seeds in it, and they're genetic seeds. And they basically go a certain time, and then after that, things start to fall apart. And my grandfather, for example, had a very similar, I had much of my protoplasmic stuff from my grandfather and my father's side, and his time to die was about the age I am right now. He died of a stroke, high blood pressure. I'm dealing with the high blood pressure. I have finally gotten so I don't have to take the medicine anymore, and my blood pressure is good. But I'm working on long life practice. I'm working on that. I'm working on other kinds of things myself. But I'm working on them not just medically, but esoterically, so that I will be, not just so that when I'm 75, I'll look like I'm 50. That's not for my vanity, but so that I'll be able to move and talk and think and be sharp. My teacher, Mother Jenny, to the day she died at the age of 97, she was totally there, and she was totally operative, and she was physically operative. And that is the goal that we want to achieve. We want to make our bodies smart. We want to advantage our bodies. They are the first elemental that serves us. When we gain that kind of rapport and that kind of reconciliation and friendship with our own natural, the closest elementals there are, which are the ones that we live in, then we can gain also relationships with other elemental beings for other kinds of work. Now, some masters who are very developed in out-of-body work, astral work, exomatosis, they do not, when their body wears out, and there is, you can't keep your body going forever. 100 or 105 is about as long as you can keep that. It's like blowing a bubble. If you blow it very carefully, it'll get very big, and then if you just let it go very skillfully, it will sit there, and it will be a bubble. But if you're not skillful, you blow and it'll pop. Or you blow it three-quarters of the way before you get and it'll pop. Or by the time you finally release it, it'll pop. And keeping your body healthy and making your life long and powerful is a skill. Just like that. It's like playing music. It's like blowing bubbles. You're blowing a big bubble, and you want to make it a big and beautiful bubble, and you don't want it to pop. And it's the same thing with long life practices. Well, masters who have used their physical flesh as long as nature allows it to be used and as well as it can be used. It's just like the Indians that used everything from the buffalo. You use everything from your body. They sometimes choose not to take rebirth. Sometimes they just choose never to take another rebirth, and they just leave the body at the time that they will. Or they sometimes choose to not to be born again in a new body, but to walk into another body. Because all around the world, there are at all times available bodies, healthy bodies, that are being left by their higher principles. People who choose to kill their bodies and commit suicide. People who, there are various circumstances by which people lose their lives, and some of them choose to lose their lives. Or the most common being that there is a karmic reason why a person at a certain age suddenly leaves his body and dies in his sleep or something like that. Such a body, and masters like this will spend years, the last years of their lives, they will spend maybe half their time, maybe half their sleep time, half their astral time, they will spend searching to find the right body. And when they do find the right body and have read the karma and know that the time is coming, the time that then comes when that body becomes available, there is a period of 5 minutes when the body can be taken over by another being. Now, Michael asked the question when we were dealing with the first empowerment of whether using another person's vehicle is always against spiritual law, and I said yes, because we were speaking about obsession and possession, and we were speaking about the spiritual lawfulness of that. But in fact, and I stress that it's always wrong, but there is, and now I have to give the exception to the rule, there is use by a master in cases of what in Sanskrit is called shva-rupa-avesha, or shva-rupa-vesha. I'm giving you the three Sanskrit words. When a mahatma who has mastered his own amsa, or is a master of the astral vehicle, by agreement with a chela, with a disciple, he sends it into the chela's physical vehicles while the chela himself purposely puts himself outside of his body through a technique that we will learn later, and is remains in his astral body while the master then, and he might be in a sleep or a trance or something, while the master then comes in and works or speaks in the personality of the chela in the chela's body. That is one lawful case, and that's called shvarupavesha. And on the other hand, when by potent force of willpower, which is called sankalpa, the mahatma influences or overshadows or controls the chela's seeming or apparent personality so that the chela will speak foreign languages and perform magical acts that only an adept might do and so on, that's called shakti avesha or shaktivesha. That is, as the term indicates, working through telepathic control of the nerve channels. But that is also by permission, if not of the actual personality, by permission of the higher self of that being. This does not happen 1% of the time that people claim it happens. Or I'm a channel for so-and-so, and I'm a channel for so-and-so. This does not happen. This, the most of those people are deluded. But there are times when that happens, and that's done. But in those times, the person through whom it happens has to be an advanced disciple and have received some kind of instruction in some way for that to be correct. In both cases, this sort of stepping into another's vehicles by permission and for high and divine purposes is not against spiritual law. It requires great adeptship on the part of the master and highly attuned obedience, as well as certain carefully developed mediumistic talents on the part of the chela, of the sort that in any other situation would be detrimental to his spiritual evolution, because it requires inattention, but it's not really inattention, it's a planned inattention, and it requires control by subliminal forces, but by a very carefully chosen subliminal force, you see. So this is possible using a technique of, as I say, Shvarupa Vesha, for a master to also transfer his higher principles from his own worn-out and dying physical body to a healthy young body of another person who is not his chela, but whose higher principles are in the act of departing according to spiritual law from that body and leaving a healthy body behind, which will only live a very short while before it's irreparably damaged, has brain damage and so on. Now, this is done. It has been done. It's only rarely done, but it's done by masters of the white-robed lodges, and there are many circles of the white-robed lodges. But it is very often attempted by adepts of the left-hand path, because they want very much to stay in body, the ones that are in body, and have developed really strong ability to control animals by willpower and things like that, and they will steal bodies. And in which case, they do not wait for a body to become available, but they wait for the opportunity when they can cut the body off, the one that they want, and they take it. And they essentially commit psychic murder. They take it by force. And this has occurred many times in history, especially with people placed in positions of power and wealth, that they have been actually, such people have been taken over because they're in positions that are attractive to these beings who have, the adepts who have developed these things. Now, there's a whole, that's a subject of another whole lecture, but the reason I mention all these things and this whole business about Avesha is that there are legitimate, spiritually right ways in which it is possible for a person, a great adept, a great master, who is in the midst of a great work that has to be completed and his body isn't going to make it, it is possible for him to then take another body. And that is done only very rarely and very secretly, and such beings that work and these other bodies are very anonymous and very, any notice would be taken of in any special kinds of ways. And it has been done. And, but it's done out of, on an emergency basis. It's not done as a practice, but that has been done too. However, it is very common that masters work telepathically with us, for example, because they have permission to work with us already. I mean, we're already working with them on subjective levels. And that is why many times in certain circumstances we will find ourselves overshadowed. And many of us will find ourselves speaking or writing or doing things that, well, when we later thought about it, we thought, gee, I was really on then. I was really high then. What was I doing? What was going on at that time? And at that time, you were under overshadowing or overlighting, but not as a channel in a psychic way, but you were under very strong telepathic direction and guidance. And that comes to you in your life, and it happens in many different times in different kinds of ways. And it is something that really you don't plan on in the first stages. You don't plan on it. It's something that comes to you at certain times. It's a gift. It comes to you when you sleep also. You're taken when you sleep in things that you can't remember, or you might only remember just a little bit, and given certain kinds of training and things like that at that time. But the time comes when your particular work, when it becomes fruitful enough, when you become dense enough, when you become there enough and focused enough in evolutionary work, that gets very much empowered and made radiant. So that whether it's just you're going into a classroom each day and teaching, there's a certain amount of overshadowing empowerment that happens there. Or speaking as I am with you all making a tape here, there's a very powerful overshadowing, but it's not that anyone is speaking through me or using my mouth. Rather, I was given instruction for this lecture. It's been accumulated. It's given to me, always on time. Mother Jane used to have her lessons every morning at 10 o'clock in the morning. Temple time, she said. And she would sit down, and right then at that time, she would be giving, and she would write and write and write. And that's where her education came, not from books. And she knew more than most books I've ever read, believe me. And so we get our teachers, we get our guidance in that kind of way, and it's done through those kinds of impressions. As far as taking control of our bodies, and as an automatic writing and things like that, those things...